So my co-presenter, Chuck Shea, is unable to be here with us today because he's back there. But we have this. Hopefully this will be accepted after the revision we're into now, and it'll be coming out in OVS. So this is kind of a nice summary of some work that we've been doing for a couple of years, but we finally decided to put it in writing is because we're ready to do our next steps. So I have been instructed that I need to read to you verbatim that I have no relationships to disclose, no personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation existing during the past 12 months. And neither does Chuck either, even though he's not here. So Chuck is actually just in the similar program that I'd worked in to get my PhD. He's actually a health economist. He was following the health econ track, and I was following the health services research and policy track. And when I did my certificate in health economics, Chuck was a TA in my class, and we ended up kind of, this was started off as an idea for a project. And what we really wanted to find out was, can we improve driver safety within the mechanisms that we already have? So we decided to go back and work on this and take a look at the data that we had. And so I want to share with you how we got to the point that we're at from the policy perspective, and then share with you some of the intervention analyses, which involves cost-effectiveness analysis. So mine is more the front part, back part's more Chuck's, but yet we did it together, so I'm kind of proud of us. So we all understand the importance of driving, especially for the older adult population. It improves independence. It's a primary means of travel. One of the things that is starting to finally get good recognition in the literature has to do with safety and motor vehicle collision. And interesting, there's a ton of data, and just trying to compile all that was a big job. But we do see that the motor vehicle collision rate per mile driven for older drivers is very similar to that of younger drivers, which can be somewhat surprising. But we also find from the literature, the evidence tells us that they face increased injury issues, and they have one of the highest death rates per vehicle mile traveled in motor vehicle collision. Vision is not just the only thing that contributes. We also know that there are functional deficits from cognitive and other medical comorbidities, and we, from the public health perspective, know that there are a lot of people that are injured. You have 3,000 older drivers that are killed and about 100,000 that can be non-fatally injured in traffic and crashes. Now, one of the challenges that we have is identifying the patient, the older driver population with vision impairment. We know it's common. There are many different estimates of prevalence. We are looking at an estimate of 3.5 million from our plethora of information out there. We have about 1.5 million people who have what we would diagnose as moderate vision impairment, based on acuity, less than 2060, including 2070, up to 2160, or depending on what chart, this is basically Medicare language, or severe vision impairment, and those are the folks that would be considered legally blind. That's where the category fits into severe vision impairment. The other issues that affect the driving behaviors are visiting the doctor, talking about it with folks that can counsel you on driving. And we do know that only about half, a little over half of individuals actually follow through on recommended eye examination, professional recommendations made for eye care. There is also no consensus, because we have 50 little test beds around the country in essence. There's no consensus on who, what, or when an individual with vision impairment should or can be allowed to drive. So we have a lot of different, a lot of variation from state to state. Chronic vision impairment affects people's ability to gain licensure, to maintain licensure, and it restricts licensure. So even if people are eligible, most of our patients will self-restrict from the road prior to somebody telling them that they can't drive or shouldn't drive because of legal requirements anymore. However, there is no consensus on what visual criteria we need to look for from the examination perspective and what risk factors we should be looking out for that can improve driver safety in the older driver population. And there remains a limited empirical basis for the certain types of vision testing policies that are used amongst the states. The key is that vision impairment does not equal poor driving. There is not substantive evidence that fully supports that assumption. So when we think about vision impairment, we think from a driving perspective mostly about acuity, and in most states, something about visual field, and then there's variations on a theme from there. But there are many other aspects of vision impairment. This is just a simulation that kind of shares with you central loss, peripheral loss, neurological difficulties, contrast sensitivity, cornea and media opacities, etc. So the one of the challenges just in trying to identify our population for study is how do we identify in our evidence what vision impairment really means? And we have huge variations. So it can vision impairment can reference based from our research perspective, from the evidence that's out there. Some studies will reference it from people who with legal blindness to total impairment, to people who have near normal vision, which are folks that would not necessarily have a restriction on their driver's license but can't see 20/20 per se. People with uncorrected refractive error, which is a misnomer, because uncorrected refractive error, when corrected, does usually not result in vision impairment. So that is a very commonly misrepresented thing in some of the literature, but we're getting better at seeing less of that. Oftentimes, vision impairment is classified according to a disease or according to a clinical classification, like end-stage glaucoma or diabetic retinopathy, or by a particular state's Medicare beneficiary coverage language. The visual acuity that is used in our research and in our literature may or may not even reflect visual field components, which are oftentimes the main other associated visual issue that's looked at at a state level. Now, so just trying to identify the study population and trying to narrow in who these folks are, we also have, you know, and this is something that I think I've really come to appreciate the last few years working in my training is that it's very difficult to differentiate between what functional limitations might be represented alone or what combination of criteria are being used. If it's a self-report, which is really how a lot of our data is gathered, self-reporting vision impairment versus an actual report of vision impairment based on a diagnosis code. There are instruments and survey questions that don't necessarily measure visual acuity or visual impairment accurately. And we still have no universal consensus on what the term low vision means. There is no universally accepted definition of that term, although all of us in this room probably have an idea in our mind of what that means when you see it. The other things we have to think about is when we have changes coming down the road for our ICD-10 classification code sets, we're going to have different diagnostic codes to identify vision impairment based on the literature and the information we've had up to that point. And then we also don't have in our clinical classifications in the U.S. Loss of function because of hemianopic defects, contrast sensitivity problems, photophobia issues, distortion, diplopia, perceptual problems, and a very common population to show why this is important has to do with the interest in acquired brain injury and a lot of the sequelae that go on with that. So as an example, one of Zinji's colleagues, former colleagues, John Cruz, had given me this information a while ago with a talk that he had done. This is just a representation of trying to identify a number of what vision impairment is. So from a surveillance standpoint, we have a ways to go, and that's one thing we think can always be strengthened with good studies, is surveilling our population and knowing who they are. So we have ranges everywhere from 3.3 to 21.2 million, depending on the age range, the criteria, and the particular survey that was done. So that talks about the evidence. And then we have the component of clinical practice. And even though ARC recognizes two clinical guidelines in the U.S., that are evidence-based, they are not necessarily as strong in evidence as they should be according to the Institute of Medicine. So those and the two are from the Academy of Ophthalmology and the American Optometric Association, they eventually will be modified, and they will continue to modify as clinical guidelines go. But there are also many policy statements. There are recommendations. We have a motorist vision policy, a statement on bioptic driving. There's lots out there that talks about driving and vision, but they all kind of come at it from a little different perspective. And then just to share with you the issue of getting to the people that can help folks with vision impairment consider driving as an option and letting them understand what they are, this is just a little bit of work from my dissertation showing that access is another factor that we need to think about and being able to hone in on people that can effectively assist older drivers with vision impairment. So what this shows is a census done throughout the United States is that we have about 1,000 doctors that provide vision rehabilitation care. Now there may be more that deal with driving and vision loss, but from a conservative estimate, these are the folks that are treating vision impairment validated. We only, and it's about a 31-to-1 ratio. So the majority of the docs that are providing care are optometrists. So the darker green are the states where there are a higher density, and the white and the lighter green are lower density. The biggest take home with regards to driver's licensure is that policies that are currently in use and the ones that have primarily been used to date are used to identify older drivers who are assumed to have an elevated risk of motor vehicle collision due to reduced acuity. And so they would ultimately result in licensure restriction. But yet there's a lot of widespread variation amongst our states with regards to what's acceptable acuity, when should you renew. For an example, in Arizona, my driver's license is good for 25 years. So, that's when I picked that up back in 2003. So
it tells you when your 65th birthday is.
Yes. I won't tell you that. You can do the math, you know, if you want to do that. So the bottom, thank you for that. That was lovely. I appreciate that. I hope I look younger than that. All of this is basically tied into the fact that we have a lack of conclusive evidence that can support that the current state vision laws, what they call screening laws or what we would consider our guidelines, actually target older drivers to improve public safety. So we know all states look at acuity. Most states look at visual field. Some don't. And there are some requirements based on making through the first threshold. If you're not that unrestricted licensure category, the next licensure category may indicate that you can have to have other additional tests done. But the bottom line is that not everybody who wants to drive will be able to, and not everybody who legally can drive will choose to do so. Licensure status is ultimately determined by the state, but we have to provide those recommendations, and we sign off on that legally. So we know that the current evidence in the data basically says that what we know is associated with motor vehicle collision loss, and this is from our more recent large cohort studies, severe visual field loss. So we're not talking about real small amounts of field loss or even a hemianopic defect. We're talking about severe, which would be more of a 20-degree association. Useful field of view, binocular visual field loss, and glare sensitivity. But factors that have not been found to be significantly associated with motor vehicle collision are acuity, contrast sensitivity, depth perception, some visual field defects if the acuity is in the moderate range, and eye diseases. So that's a little counterintuitive to the way that our licensure standards are at this point. So I'm going to run through this next part very quickly because I'm running out of time, but I want to make sure I at least get through it. So our getting to this point, our statement of the problem, our question is, how can we translate this effectively, this emerging evidence, into the process? And what is that process? So we're even just starting to detangle what that is. And is there an effective way to bridge all of these different three areas that we came up with, the population perspective with our research evidence, the legal perspective on who has to tell the state what to do and when, and then the clinical perspective, the folks that are actually making these effective recommendations and evaluating the patients. So we identified an older driver triad, and at the center of the triad of these three areas, one of the things that we identified as being a key nexus point is a comprehensive eye examination. So we asked the question, what would be the potential impact if we required an annual eye examination for all older drivers over the age of 65 to improve safety? There's a lot of reasons why an exam is of intrinsic value, and I listed those, I won't read them. But we decided to start with, as a preliminary assessment, to look at the economic impact of this as a potential policy. So what we decided to do was do a cost-effectiveness analysis. So we modeled, and I won't go into all the details, I'll show you the slides because of the time issue, but we modeled an analysis to reflect the current driving standards. So it really reflects acuity and the current classifications in the vast majority of states that would require an individual to have a restricted license or a non-restricted license. And then we looked over a one-year time horizon. So our next step is to look at maybe a two-year time horizon for folks that are recommended to have an exam every 2 years instead of those that might be more at risk. We had many, many assumptions, and from a health economic standpoint, they live on assumptions. And so that was a joke for Chuck, who wasn't here. But we broke it basically into three alternatives, a low, moderate, and severe VI category. And what we did, this is an example of our model base and base case parameters. We had three potential outcomes: fatality, injury without death, or property damage, and we basically based all of our assumptions on data that was currently available. And one of the things that we found was that we need more efficient data. This is an example of our decision tree, which doesn't show up very well. So the results section. We found that it was about $6.8 billion if we implemented an annual eye examination intervention. And that would basically cover almost 28 million people, and we estimated $250. So what we, and I won't go into the details of under the different alternatives, but what we actually found was that we can reduce motor vehicle collision. We can do that with either a low threshold or a high vision threshold. But the key for this was that, and this just repeats that data and shows that what was dominated, was that the reductions in motor vehicle collision or the improvement in safety comes at a very, very high price. So the take home is that licensure policies that rely solely on VA, which is a predominant assumption we made in our modeling, do not appear to be a cost-effective solution. So we are starting to see that maybe we have to come up with a different intervention alternative besides just looking at either the way the policies are, or we have to tie in other data that might make it a little more cost effective. So that isn't, I don't think, the primary, the real important take homes of this work. I think what we did is we identified areas where we need more evidence, where we need to be very specific from the scientific community and advocating to our research funders what we need to do and what assistance we need so that they can prioritize public safety with regards to motor vehicle collision, especially for older drivers. And we need to get more evidence, and which is emerging, in order to help us refine our model and do a better job at coming up with a more refined assessment of cost so that we can translate that into other areas. One thing that we identified with driving is that it requires a much larger approach and scope, which most of us need, but there's an emerging analytical process called a health impact assessment. And this would be an excellent approach to looking at all of the different pieces that fit into the driving issue. So I know that's kind of a quick read through the slides, but I just wanted to let you know that we found our next steps are to move on, but that was our preliminary finding. So thank you very much, and I'm sorry I ran over a minute.
Thank you, Dr. Grover. And would you like to come up? I think we have a minute or two for some questions, if anyone has a question. Sure.
Hey. Hi. Did you consider in your model at all, I know there's been development of driver's exams, like having somebody driving the car, a professional driving the car with the subject and verifying they can physically drive adequately. Did you include any of that?
No. What we did, because this was our, because we just kind of wanted to do the model based on cost of exam, being entree kind of into the system and at the point of the nexus, we didn't take it any further than that. Our next steps are to look at a two-year time horizon, which makes it a much more complex model, but then also consider some of the subtleties that you get at the state level. And that would definitely include if it was a mandatory road test. Or, you know, the problem that we have is when we go to explore some of those other alternatives, there's not a lot of high quality solid evidentiary data to base your assumptions on. So our assumptions are only as good as what we can support. And that, I think, was a real interesting take home. I mean, as a more of a novice in health services research. But I think that that's a really a good take home that most of you probably already know. But I think that is an important thing, and also the issue of having a larger timeline, because even though most of our folks at 65 are recommended to have routine eye care for all other reasons besides driving, some of them either don't go every year or they are told not to go every year. So that's another issue. And that kind of overrides the state issue, but there are many, many factors like that at the state level that we want to take a look at. Thank you.